Last Friday, a top White House aide said it was possible Republicans could impeach President Obama. GOP House Leader John Boehner says talk of impeachment is a scam started by Democrats. It's Politics Day here on River to River. From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we ask our analysts, Bruce Gronbeck of the University of Iowa and Bruce Nesmith of Coe College, what's really behind the talk of impeachment? Also, the open U.S. Senate seat in Iowa, at the epicenter of the GOP battle to reclaim power in the U.S. Senate. And it's been 10 years since then-Senator Obama gave the speech at the DNC that started it all. Has your thinking about Obama changed in the last decade? How? Join our conversation after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday, we're so excited, has arrived once again with its regular Wednesday appearance. And today on the program, we have two very able analysts to pick apart a few things we have in store for you. Bruce Gronbeck is joining us by phone, Emeritus Professor of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa. Hi, Bruce.
How you doing?
And we're very frugal with the names. Another Bruce on the show today, Bruce Nesmith, Joan and Abbott Lipsky Professor of Political Science at Coe College. Bruce Nesmith, welcome to you as well.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Good afternoon to you. And little game plan. Let's explain a little bit about what we're going to do. We're going to talk a little bit about a milestone that stretches back 10 years in a moment, then go on to some of the political developments as of late this week. The talk of impeachment, to be particular, and then we'll look abroad as well at the political challenges posed by the ongoing conflicts in Gaza as well as Ukraine. But, gentlemen, let's start off with this, and I want to make sure our listeners hear this because we want our listeners to join in this hour. It was the speech that started it all. 10 years ago, then-Senator Barack Obama's Democratic National Convention keynote address started his journey to the White House. 18 minutes in Boston. 18 minutes that reshaped American politics. There was the lanky young senator from Illinois spending a long passage of his speech extolling Democratic nominee, presidential nominee John Kerry, of course. But Kerry wasn't the one whose presidential prospects most people left the convention buzzing about. The crowd went wild. You remember that if you saw this speech. A decade later, the speech remains a roadmap to the Obama agenda and many places where he's fallen short in his term and a half so far. Let's listen to a couple clips. Here is then-Senator Obama from Illinois telling us that we're not as divided as we might think.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America. The pundits like to slice and dice our country into red states and blue states. Red states for Republicans, blue states for Democrats. But I've got news for them, too. We worship an awesome God in the blue states, and we don't like federal agents poking around in our libraries in the red states. We coach Little League in the blue states. And yes, we've got some gay friends in the red states.
Okay, President Obama also reminded the crowd that then-Senator Obama, I keep reminding myself of that, he also reminded the crowd that the party's nominee, John Kerry, still had much work to do and foreshadowed the agenda of his own presidential campaign.
More work to do for the workers I met in Galesburg, Illinois, who are losing their union jobs at the Maytag plant that's moving to Mexico, and now are having to compete with their own children for jobs that pay $7 an hour. More to do for the father that I met who was losing his job and choking back the tears, wondering how he would pay $4,500 a month for the drugs his son needs without the health benefits that he counted on. More to do for the young woman in East St. Louis and thousands more like her who has the grades, has the drive, has the will, but doesn't have the money to go to college.
President Obama, 10 years ago at the Democratic National Convention. Let me go to you first, Bruce, because you focus on political rhetoric in your work in communication studies. I want to get to Bruce Nesmith as well, of course. But give us your thoughts as we look back on this milestone speech 10 years later.
Well, you know, it's an agenda he has tried to keep up. It's a broadly progressive agenda focused strongly on the middle class, asking for the development of governmental mechanisms to keep their lives moving on and expanding in positive ways. He won't give up on that. He hammers at it again and again and again. The color coding, gets parodied a lot, and probably should be.
Mm-hmm.
But the central vision of a middle class on the rise, coming back, writing proudly with the help of government programs, is there all the way.
The color coding you're referring to, the line most associated with his speech, there's not a liberal America and a conservative America, there's the United States of America. Bruce Nesmith, that has to be the line most reflective for people most remember from this speech. Also the line that turned out not to be the case at all. It's not a line we hear from the president these days and haven't heard for a long time.
No, and it makes me think about, because this is also close to the anniversary of the Cairo speech in foreign policy, and while both were good speeches, I think that the enthusiastic reaction to both says more about the audiences than it does about the speaker himself. President Obama is a very capable speaker, but I don't think he's, you know. Well, to start with, by correcting your correction, he was not then Senator Obama. He had not yet been elected to the Senate in 2004. And there was a sense in which he was getting, you know, put into the Hall of Fame before he'd thrown an actual pitch. So I'm struck by how much people want a world in which, you know, we can live together and our politics, our separate political opinions are one part of us, but it doesn't define us. That the world can get along and we don't have lines, iron curtains and things like that dividing nations, that people fundamentally are more or less just want to get along and live together. And I think there's maybe a deep-seated hunger in America and the world that be true, and maybe it isn't quite as true as we wish it were.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that correction. Senator, though he was a state senator at that time, not a U.S. senator. Are we right on that?
I think so.
Okay. 10 years ago, let's get some input from Iowa Public Radio listeners. Do you remember that speech at the Democratic National Convention, the keynote that Barack Obama delivered 10 years ago that started his journey to the White House? Has your thinking about Barack Obama evolved in those 10 years since that landmark speech? Tell us how. What is your opinion of him and his vision, how that's changed in the past 10 years? What do you see as his successes, as his disappointments, as your disappointments in him, I guess I should say? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. River to river at iowapublicradio.org. Our email, Iowa Public Radio, also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Politico had an interesting article about this that looked back at the key lines of the speech, which ones held up, which ones do not. Here's a line from the speech. Bruce Gronbeck, do we participate in a politics of cynicism or do we participate in a politics of hope? Of course, that last word, hope, very much a part of the identity that Obama sought in his campaign.
Oh, well, the hope theme, again, I think is part of that progressive vision, because you're setting a goal outside of your present circumstances and your present mechanisms for getting kinds of changes wrought in society that you think are important. So it is something always forward from you, never inside your own spheres of action right now. I think was tremendously important for him to see if he could get that brought back into the vision of the populace. And frankly, he couldn't do it. He couldn't do it. As they became split inside the Republican Party, and for that matter, inside the Democratic Party as well, always the group of liberals disappointed in what Obama would do. The theme of hope, it seems to me, ended up itself seeming like almost a cynical reaction.
Reflecting on a speech at the DNC 10 years ago by then State Senator Barack Obama, 1-866-780-9100 to reflect, give us your reflections on how your thinking about Barack Obama has evolved over the years. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We had that question about the question that Barack Obama then stated, participating in the politics of cynicism or in the politics of hope. We have had hyper-partisan politics with us now for many years. It seems to be increasing. No let-up there, Bruce Nesmith. I wonder if these hyper-partisan times had how much did Barack Obama play in that? He started off, didn't he, as a player who said he was going to work with both parties.
Yes, as did George W. Bush, and as did Bill Clinton to a certain extent, particularly after 1994. And, you can always find ways in which people fell short of what they might have done, made mistakes and things like that. But I think at this point, we can pretty much say that the partisan atmosphere is beyond the control of one person, even one president, one leader, to affect that. This is what it is, and it's going to be this way for a while. And no matter who gets elected in 2016, it's going to continue to be the case on into the next decade.
Joshua joins us from Waverly. Joshua dialed 1-866-780-9100. Hi, Joshua. You want to chime in on our present topic here?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing. Go ahead.
I just want to echo what your last caller said.
What specifically, Joshua? Joshua's gone. Okay, let's go to Karen in Des Moines. Hi, Karen.
Hello. I just want to make the point that my views about Obama, I voted for him twice. I would vote for, depends on who ran, I might vote for him again. It's context for me.
Mm-hmm.
We had a very, what I consider to be a very bad president who started an unfounded war and who left us in a financial pickle. And then we combined that with what I perceive to be a racial animosity toward this person. We liked him because he was a very bright, scholarly individual. Now we find out he doesn't really have much desire to be, you know, a politician, a warm person who invites others in and kind of negotiates with them. And so we have this standoff situation where if he's not the personality guy, why we're going to thwart everything he does. And the whole context of our country has changed for me. I'm not very hopeful that people can get beyond the partisanship. We're not Americans anymore. We're Republicans or Democrats. And I think it's very disheartening.
Mm-hmm. Where do you place the blame for that? On our system? On the president? On the Republicans?
Well, I think it's all of that. That's the problem. You can't just fix one of these things. We'll elect whoever we elect the next time, and the other side will hate them because they'll get into the partisanship. I don't know how we unravel this because it's in our heads, and I'm pretty sure that we have to unravel it between each other right here with the neighbor next door and in not shouting in public meetings and drumming each other out and shouting each other down. I'm not quite sure how to get off the treadmill.
Okay, Karen in Des Moines, thank you for your thoughts. We're reflecting on the moment that President Obama, then State Senator Obama, entered the national stage with that amazing speech, 18 minutes long, before the Democratic National Convention, then nominating John Kerry as the nominee in 2004. Reflecting on President Obama's speech then, the vision he had, and what has happened in the meantime. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Caller from Des Moines, Paul?
Yes, thanks for taking my call. When I remember that speech, it's what I imagine it must have been like for those for whom President Kennedy was their inspirational person. It was a total change for me. I've always been an independent. That inspired me to go ahead and get more actively involved in politics. And when he ran for president, I remember thinking at that point my wife was pregnant with our first, and I didn't. When my daughter was going to ask me someday what I did, I didn't. I had to make sure that I could tell her that I was part of the campaign that helped elect President Obama. It's been, a life-changing experience for me, and I'll never forget that speech.
Mm-hmm. And have your thoughts evolved, and how?
Sure. I think that President Obama is an example of what happens when it's not a true politician that runs things. I don't think that's bad. Things are difficult right now, and that's going to continue to be, but that's how change happens. And as much as I may disagree with the Tea Party, as much of my blood may boil when I hear certain things that are stated perhaps on a Fox News, at the end of the day, I can be a Democrat, someone else can be a Republican, and in this country, you can sleep at night and you're safe. And I think that when we look at what's going on in other parts of the world, that it could be so much worse. And I don't have a problem with our process at all.
Okay, thank you very much, Paul in Des Moines. Susan in Cedar Rapids, what tune are you singing?
Hello?
Yes, Susan in Cedar Rapids, you're on the air. Go ahead with your thoughts.
Oh, my comment is that considering the despicable behavior of Congress, I think President Obama has done a wonderful job. And at every turn we see that he's full of compassion for the people and has worked like a trooper for us. And I just flinch every time I think about that Congress. And I think all of those Congress people need to be booted out. So that's my opinion.
Susan in Cedar Rapids, thank you so much. Bruce Nesmith, talk about that, the relationship between Congress. We're seeing Congress at very low approval ratings as well.
Sure. And Congress is pretty much always low approval ratings, but the last 5 years have been pretty historic in terms of lower than the previous 5 years or the 5 years before that. So this is pretty bad, pretty low approval. Congress is kind of stuck. I think the people who are on the left in Congress have incentives to do things, and the people who are on the right have incentives to do things, and there does not seem to be, at this point, a political incentive for compromise. Maybe given that there's a Democratic president, there might be more of an incentive for Democrats to compromise so that something can be accomplished. But there does not seem to be an incentive, a political incentive existing to bring people together over almost everything, although, occasionally there will be something that gets done. The veterans system bailout got done, and there may yet be something to done on immigration.
Bruce Nesmith is with us of Coe College, and Bruce Gronbeck of the University of Iowa joining us on this Politics Day. Let's move on to, Paul in another Paul. This is a different Paul in Des Moines. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how's it going?
Going very well. Thank you very much. What do you want to throw into the mix?
Well, when I heard Obama's speech 10 years ago, I knew right away that he would be our first and then our next president. But, I had a lot of hope for him, and I felt like, first term in, he was just right into the game of planned politics.
Mm-hmm.
He was not trying to upset the right side too much and keep the left side on his side too. And I feel like he could have really been a stronger president and really stood strong and had, his ideals really come through. But I really don't think he did that. I don't think he put the proof in the pudding. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Okay, Paul. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for sharing your thoughts. Bruce Gronbeck, what are your thoughts as you hear some Iowans speak out about their introduction to Barack Obama and what they think today?
Well, I think it played very, very well in Iowa, and Iowa is indeed an important swing state. There's a large enough group of middling Iowans to move their presidential vote to the left or to the right. So I think it has played well. The social agenda of Obama, I suspect, might be a little urbanized for most Iowans, at least until they get around to the farm bills and so on. But he has, I think, played in a middling sort of way. Not as strong a negative reaction as other places, mm-hmm. and not as strong an affirmative reaction as other places as well. I think they're floating down the middle, which I think in turn then keeps Iowa on that swinging gait when it's going to get time to the electoral process. And I'm talking not only about Obama, but the other offices. And of course, the House and Senate as well.
Edward tweets on this topic, business as usual, no change. Bruce Nesmith, when we reflect on 10 years ago, Barack Obama entering our national consciousness, or many of ours, what can we say about the next 2 years? He has two more years of office.
And typically, the seventh and eighth years of a presidency are pretty low achievement years, and particularly if Republicans gain the Senate, I think the opportunity to do virtually anything in the next 2 years is pretty limited, which might free him to do some prophecy if that's what he's inclined to do. My sense is probably not. I think what I'm hearing from a lot of the callers is that they expected him to be more of a change agent than he's turned out to be.
A transcendent figure, that's asking a lot, isn't it, to transcend an entire system that has been built up over 230-some years?
Yeah, and I think, you know, when we look at him now, we've, you know, on 6 years acquaintance, that that's not his inclination. You know, he's not Martin Luther King. Besides that, I think that a year before he became president, I think he envisioned himself being a different president than he turned out to be, simply because the economy was in such horrible shape when he became president that absolutely had to take priority over virtually everything else.
Mm-hmm. Good economic news we heard in our news today. U.S. economic growth accelerating more than expected in the second quarter, and the decline in output in the prior period less steep than previously reported. Bolstering views for a stronger performance in the last 6 months of the year. That's Commerce Department releasing figures today. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment, but we want to move on to talk about using impeachment as a fundraising tool. Last Friday, a top White House aide said it was possible Republicans could impeach President Obama if he decided to take executive action on immigration. Yesterday, House Speaker John Boehner fired back at this chatter. He said, listen, it's all a scam started by Democrats at the White House. We'll ask our analysts what's behind this strange talk of impeachment. When we return, it's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, Politics Day. Hope you'll join us for the second half hour. So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News on this very pleasant, sunny afternoon on the 30th of July, 2014. Tomorrow on this program, you can come along with me as I sit in the driver's seat of a semi-autonomous car. I'll be with Daniel McGeehee, director of the Vehicle Research Safety Lab at the University of Iowa. Completely driverless cars will soon be tested on the roads of Johnson County. So tune in for that tomorrow on the program. Today, we're driving through a political landscape, as we like to do on Wednesdays. Our guests, Bruce Gronbeck, Emeritus Professor of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa, Bruce Nesmith, Joan and Abbott Lipsky Professor of Political Science at Coe College. And let's talk about this talk of impeachment. It's quite interesting here. Last Friday, A top White House aide said it was possible Republicans could impeach President Obama if he decided to take executive action on immigration. Yesterday, House Speaker John Boehner fired back at this impeachment chatter.
Why? Because they're trying to rally their people to give money and to show up in this year's election. We have no plans to impeach the president. We have no future plans. Listen, it's all a scam started by Democrats at the White House.
President John Boehner there, the GOP House Speaker. Very strange, I guess. Doesn't happen every day. Members of your own party talking about bringing up impeachment and this reaction by John Boehner. Bruce Nesmith, what's going on here?
Well, I think that Speaker Boehner had it right as far as he went. I think that this is a great fundraising effort for Democrats, and it's been the whole lawsuit business is an empty suit as well. I think it's an effort to jones up the Republican base. So that's pretty much what you've got. You've got trying to rally the bases. I get emails. I would say I get email about every hour from the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and hardly ever using the word lawsuit, mostly using the word impeachment. My guess is that may be more exciting than the lawsuit.
Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee says it's raked in more than $3 million in online donations since last Thursday with solicitations like the one. Here's one from House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. Boehner is planning a vote to sue the president. The House of Representatives has never sued a sitting president in all of U.S. history, and if they do it, impeachment may very well be the next step. So, Bruce Gronbeck, is this unprecedented? I'm not sure I've heard of this before.
Oh, no, it's not really. The dirty campaigns of 68 and 72 didn't use an appeal quite like that, but were known to, in both sides, have stolen letterhead so they could write to members of their own party and the opposition party, leaking it around and various kinds of actions like that. The impeachment one, I don't know of anything quite so public as that. Mm-hmm. Most of the rest of the things that have gone on have gone on through the U.S. mail or robocalls or whatever else.
Bruce Nesmith, am I remembering correctly that Democrats had some talk of impeachment in 1998, Bill Clinton president there, when the impeachment proceedings against Clinton came about, and they sort of backfired in that on the GOP in that midterm.
I think so. I forgot about that. Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think this has been kind of sustained in the mailings from the outside PACs. The talk of impeachment isn't brand new right now, but it might be. This I'm not sure. I can't remember. It might be new for the parties to be doing it themselves.
Bruce Nesmith, you want to join in?
Yeah, I mean, I think what you see in 1998 is that the Democrats did better when they were maybe not doing very much, but under the gun from some rather spurious charges on the part of Republicans, and that's they're going to try to make that work for them again this time.
Well,
it's certainly a lot easier to go back to some of the earlier callers like Susan in the last half hour.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly a lot easier to yell about impeachment or suing the president or, you know, whatever you want to yell about on both sides than it is to do something of substance. And that, you know, substance gets people disagreeing and gets into nuance and gets complicated. And this is uncomplicated, and it appeals to your emotions, and we can just yell about it.
When we look at Iowa politicians' role or statements on impeachment, Representative Steve King of Iowa's 4th District, the Republican representative, Congressman King, says he believes the House of Representatives will immediately begin impeachment proceedings if President Obama unilaterally grants work permits and amnesty to millions more illegal immigrants by the end of the summer. Also interesting here on this impeachment question, yesterday, Iowa Senate candidate Joni Ernst disavowing remarks she made earlier in the year in which she said President Obama's impeachment should be on the table. To quote her, "To be clear, I have not seen any evidence that the president should be impeached. I obviously do not believe the president is a dictator, but his repeated use of unilateral action sure makes him look like one." Now, however, a video clip of Ernst discussing impeachment at a January GOP candidate forum in Iowa surfaced yesterday, and that was what prompted the statement by Ernst, and I read part of that. But in the video clip from January, Ernst is asked by the forum's moderator, this is during the GOP primary, how President Obama should be punished if the Supreme Court ruled that Obama's recess appointments were an abuse of power. Quote, "I do believe the president did overstep his bounds," Ernst says in the video clip posted on AOL. She adds that he should face repercussions such as removal from office or impeachment. Ernst then criticized lawmakers on Capitol Hill for not punishing the president. This is on video from Joni Ernst in January. Clear that she is backpedaling now. Bruce Nesmith, your thoughts on why she's backpedaling there?
Well, I don't know if it's worth the time to talk about, but I would say that every party throughout history has had the trouble of simultaneously keeping the base excited and speaking to people in the middle, and it becomes more difficult in an age where everything you say is, you know, immediately available to everybody on the internet. I think that
get out of the way, Bruce.
Yeah, that was my train of thought leaving the station. I think what we've seen in the last 20 years or so, 20, 25 years, is that there's not only money and volunteer enthusiasm to be made by jonesing up the base, but that's where a lot of the votes are too. So, you know, it's a balancing act, but maybe more towards the base than to the center.
Bruce Gronbeck, you wanted to jump in there?
My train is just about gone. I agree. I agree entirely. You're out trying to pick up collections of targeted voters, and a legal move like that in a public sort of way may look comparatively easy and comparatively disturbing for the other side, and you can feel that by gum you got something done, not realizing how difficult impeachment is, and ask the Republicans about Bill Clinton. So it seems like a shot you can take without, and I agree entirely with Bruce, without having to think too deeply or move too far. You're using the court system, and that's easier than raising several million voters.
Let's stay with Joni Ernst, but move on slightly. As recently as a couple of weeks ago, the race for this open U.S. Senate seat in Iowa was pegged as leaning Democratic. Now it's considered to be at the epicenter of the GOP battle to reclaim power in the U.S. Senate, 100 days approximately from Election Day. And I wonder, Bruce Nesmith, could the way this is shaping up potentially make Iowa a decisive state for control of the Senate?
Absolutely, and I think both sides are treating it that way. If I'm sort of using the Real Clear Politics because their graphics are really, really friendly. And if you think about it, Republicans have 45 seats. They need 51 to get a majority. a couple, if they win a couple of seats that are probably pretty well conceded to them that are currently held by Democrats in Montana and South Dakota, that brings them to 47. So now they need four, and there are really 11 seats that are toss-ups, nine of them held by Democrats, so they need to pick up four of those nine. And maybe West Virginia would be one, and then that leaves eight, choosing three of those eight. And some of those states are large, like Michigan, North Carolina. Some of them are kind of remote, like Alaska, which isn't to say Republicans won't make an effort and maybe even win those states. But Iowa is small. A few dollars goes a long way in Iowa media markets. And it's compact because our media markets, except for Omaha, our media markets are pretty much, you know, within the state. It's very attractive to outside groups. And I was talking about the DCC earlier. I've gotten a lot of mailings from Americans for Prosperity. My thought is beyond the candidates and the parties, outside groups are likely to see Iowa as an epicenter. And as such, the candidates may lose control of the dialogue of the race.
Well, let's you said a few dollars go a long way, but this is politics, so we're going to assume that that's a few million dollars go a long way, especially in modern political campaigns. And to the point you were just making, Bruce Nesmith, let's listen to a new ad. This is Next Gen Climate. This is a super PAC dedicated to attacking Republicans who it claims are climate science deniers. Releasing this ad just recently, targeting Joni Ernst. You'll have to picture this. Two suited men, dark cigar smoke, meant to resemble special interests. Here they are in a slightly condensed version of this new ad discussing Joni Ernst's loyalties.
Joni signed on the line. The tax breaks that thing protects are gold.
She isn't worried about Iowa jobs.
Never mind that. Joni Ernst is with us.
Any chance she'll back out?
When pigs fly.
So, Bruce Nesmith, what do you think of that ad? I know you've seen it as well.
Yeah, I was going to say to people who are hearing that on the radio, if you thought that was incoherent, you can see it online, but it doesn't help much.
The ad will be playing in Des Moines, Cedar Rapids, and the Quad Cities markets over the next 5 weeks, by the way. But, Bruce, yeah.
Yeah, so in 1988, Dan Quayle was nominated as George Bush's running mate and ran into a lot of problems. He was a lot of public doubt about his capabilities. And somebody, the Dukakis campaign or somebody, ran a commercial featuring supposed Republican operatives discussing replacing Quayle on the ticket. And it was very clever, and the surveys found that people who saw it thought it was a Bush commercial. And I think this is another example of people who are very clever and who spend their time talking to people who are immersed in politics like them, and the commercial is incoherent.
It's just too complicated for
yeah. It's way too subtle. It's way too subtle, way too cute. You have to really be up on the issues and be paying total attention, and that's just not how most people interact with television.
Bruce Gronbeck, do you see it that way?
Yeah. I mean, what may be the saving grace is that it's the first of presumably of a series of seven ads. And so one assumes they'll get more and more explicit, that go on from here, keep the room filled with smoke, and maybe make the talk more concrete. But I agree entirely. I looked at it, and I didn't know what it was about.
Okay. Let's touch on a couple of international events, if we can, before the hour ends, developments on the political landscape. Yesterday, President Obama praised the European Union for imposing tough new sanctions on Russia, announcing additional U.S. sanctions on the country's defense, energy, and financial sectors. President Obama adding that Russia continues to isolate itself from the international community. In his words, a choice that Russia and President Putin in particular has made. The European Union reached an agreement to impose new sanctions against Russia earlier yesterday in a move that will target the country's energy and defense industries. Here's President Obama talking about those new sanctions yesterday.
I signed a new executive order today that gives us the authority to impose sanctions not just on individuals but on key sectors of the Russian economy. This is not our preferred outcome. These sanctions would not only have a significant impact on the Russian economy, but could also be disruptive to the global economy. However, Russia must know that further escalation will only isolate it further from the international community.
Bruce Nesmith, your thoughts on these further tightening of sanctions against Russia?
Well, this is one of the ways in which, you know, going back to the Cairo speech of 2009, this is one of the ways in which soft power may be working better than hard power would have, either arming militant groups or, you know, sending tons of weapons to Ukraine or soldiers or advisors or something like that. The one thing that that I'm not sure about is, you know, thinking that the model crisis handling would have been the Cuban Missile Crisis, where you allowed the Soviets a face-saving way out. And I'm not sure what the face-saving way out for Russia is here, but certainly it's impressive to see the U.S. and Europeans working more or less together on this.
Mm-hmm. Well, since you mentioned that Cairo speech a couple of times, it is an anniversary there. That was just more than 5 years ago that President Obama was in Cairo to deliver what's been referred to as the speech to the Muslim world. And in that speech, June of 2009, Obama outlined U.S. security priorities. He sought to diminish mistrust between the U.S. and Muslim nations. He explained that while the U.S. had to act in Afghanistan in response to September 11th, the attacks, the war in Iraq was different.
Unlike Afghanistan, Iraq was a war of choice that provoked strong differences in my country and around the world. Although I believe that the Iraqi people are ultimately better off without the tyranny of Saddam Hussein, I also believe that events in Iraq have reminded America of the need to use diplomacy and build international consensus to resolve our problems whenever possible. Indeed, we can recall the words of Thomas Jefferson, who said, "I hope that our wisdom will grow with our power and teach us that the less we use our power, the greater it will be." Today, America has a dual responsibility: to help Iraq forge a better future and to leave Iraq to Iraqis. And I have made it clear to the Iraqi people, that we pursue no bases and no claim on their territory or resources. Iraq's sovereignty is its own.
President Obama, 5 years ago, June of 2009. When we listen to those words, Bruce Nesmith, how does what the president said 5 years ago inform the situation that we're seeing in Iraq today with the U.S. gone?
Well, I think that things have gotten a lot more complicated in the ensuing 5 years. And one thing we've seen is that the Muslim world is a lot less coherent than it was 5 years ago. So they become more difficult to deal with. Things seem a lot less clear.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think.
To finish up here, Rand Paul coming to Iowa, the Republican U.S. Senator from Kentucky, also the son of the 3-time presidential candidate Ron Paul, popular among many in Iowa. He'll be in these presidential testing grounds next Monday through Wednesday. I wonder your thoughts on Rand Paul, Bruce Gronbeck. How do you see Rand Paul's appeal being different from his father's, or is it pretty much the same?
Yeah, no, it's not at all. I think people were expecting that. He does not have that almost anarchistic way about him that his father did of clearing out government in department after department to get it out of your way so you can walk down the road by yourself. His is much more a complicated economic plan to remake a series of institutions, not by destroying them, but by shrinking them, by combining them, by advancing. The only part I think where he's similar is in the economic plan, where he's somewhat like his father. So I think as he comes, he's working very hard to be the young new economic voice that will manipulate the economy into a healthy state.
Bruce Gronbeck, thank you for joining us, Emeritus Professor of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa. Pleasure to have you, Bruce. And the other Bruce Nesmith with us also. Joan and Abbott Lipsky, Professor of Political Science at Coe College. Bruce Nesmith, thank you.
It's been fun.
It has been.
Okay, tomorrow on the program, make sure you come along as we ride a semi-autonomous car. We'll find out about completely driverless cars as well, soon to be tested on the roads here in Iowa. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.